man. This is the old good morning man, Kermit Edney, with program number 105 in a series of 260 marking the 50th anniversary of radio station WHKP. We talk about the happenings and the people who made things happen, much the same as the great Frank L. Fitzsimmons series. So we call the program simply Where Fitz Left Off. And today we're remembering the many hats that Jimmy Fain and I each wore together back in those early years of broadcasting and newspapering. In those lean years of the late 40s, having the title of program director, or in newspapering, whatever Jimmy's title was at the time, you had the right to hire and fire, to schedule on a limited basis assignments, and you had the responsibility of riding herd on all others who worked with you. With the very small staffs that either newspaper or radio could muster, you usually assigned yourself to work duties. At WHKP's leanest, we had only a total of 6 people. That included the manager, myself, a salesman, a person in the office, and 2 other announcers to cover news, sports, and 132 hours of operation every week. The Times News, because of production requirements in the composing room and in the press room, had considerably more, but nothing in the range of the huge number of employees on the staff there now. On my watch, the most number of employees we ever had at HKP was 22. With this background in mind, when Friday nights rolled around, it was Jimmy Fain that Jimmy Fain had assigned to cover the football game. We did recruit one sports announcer, Red Reed, from Oregon for the 1947 year, but even though this was his first job in radio, his demands for a pay increase were so preposterous, we bade him best wishes and shipped him back to the West Coast. We did attempt the training of a couple of high school kids, but when they would have the ball carrier racing past the 40, he's over the 50, now he's over the 60-yard line, and he's brought down near the 70-yard line. It then became apparent that as Jimmy was doing at the Times News, it appeared Kermit would now assign Kermit to do play-by-play. I'd take Charlie Renfro with me to handle engineering because it was a cumbersome job back in those old vacuum tube days, and we'd get a young man from each school to volunteer to act as spotter for their team. That was it. That was the total crew. And I learned very early to set up our equipment on the far right side of the booth because Jimmy would be on the left. And when a play would go wrong or there'd be an official call he didn't agree with, he would explode. His voice would ricochet off the wooden sideboards of the booth, and Jim was pretty good using certain expletives. So when I'd anticipate an outburst from Jim, I'd cup my hand over the microphone, effectively shielding the listeners from what was probably much more exciting than my apprentice description of the play on the field. In 1948, when the Hendersonville Bearcats basketball team advanced to the state championship game to be played in Duke Indoor Stadium, it was a fact. We simply couldn't sell enough advertising to pay to send a crew to Durham. So I got hold of John Young, who had been a classmate of mine in the School of Radio, Television, and Motion Pictures down at Carolina, and who was now on the faculty of the school. And I persuaded John to borrow enough remote equipment from the radio school to originate the broadcast. And I caught a bus for Durham. John and I sat in the stands with other spectators and originated the broadcast, with John filling in on the color. It turned out great. And we not only broke even on the broadcast, but with that frugality made a little money. And Hendersonville won the first of back-to-back championships with players including Blondie Whitmire, John McGraw, Tommy McCulloch, Ed Morgan, Buddy Barnett. By the way, John Young later became a producer for the C.D. Chesley Company, and all those early ACC basketball originations were produced by John. The last time I saw John Young was by pure accident. He had driven up from Chapel Hill to ride the excursion steam train, the French Broad Cannonball, on its run from Spartanburg to Bulls Gap, Tennessee, in return. In those years, with just Jim Fain and I covering most of the dedications, the celebrity receptions, the queen crownings, at least you didn't have the paparazzi to contend with as you do today. Usually the largest crowd of news people would be at the Coronation Ball of the Apple Festival, and I remember in 1950, when Governor Carr Scott was to crown the queen, Jimmy was shoved into this mob of photographers in front of the stage with press people yelling, "Kiss her, Governor, kiss her!" And all of a sudden, Carr Scott glanced at them and glared and yelled, "I don't kiss no woman but my wife." If on a rare occasion one of Jim's reporters would be running late on a story and the story would slip past Jim and make it into print with obvious errors, or worse, containing material that should not have even been included, Jimmy was known to make it a memorable error for that reporter. The most professional newspaper man I ever knew, the most dedicated public servant of his time, and my friend, James Toole Fane, Jr. Great memories for the seventh child of a seventh child, lucky enough to have been born here, the good sense never to leave, and with a job he's loved all of his life. Sursum corda as we begin the next 50 years.